This show is Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. And on today's program, we will talk with the two cast members and the director of the current play at the Station Theater in Urbana. The Celebration Company there, they're putting on a new show called A Steady Rain. And we'll hear about that, the first portion of the program. And then, in advance of tomorrow night's concert by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at the Kranert Center in Urbana, I'll talk with James Smeltzer, who is a member of the horn section in the orchestra, about various topics involved in getting to become a horn player in the Chicago Symphony, being one, and then he has some comments on a couple of specific conductors, including the one who is going to be leading them at this concert, Jaap van Zweden. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Those were some excerpts from Sergei Prokofiev's music for his ballet called Romeo and Juliet. The Chicago Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Sir George Schulte here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. And I'll be talking with James Smelser, member of the horn section of the Chicago Symphony, coming up later on Live and Local in advance of their concert tomorrow night in Urbana. But first, it's A Steady Rain, a play by Keith Huff, which is being put on by the Celebration Company at the Station Theater in Urbana. Opening night was last night, I guess. And that is described here on their website as a terrific and terrifying new play from Chicago, involving just two characters and therefore two cast members. In the role of Denny is Matthew Green, and as Joey is Mike Procise, and the director is Gary Ambler. And these illustrious personages have all arrived in the studio today, and thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Gary, as the director, why don't you give us an introduction to this play? What makes it terrific and terrifying? And what's it about, for that matter?
As I clear my throat, it's about two cops. Two cops, best friends since they were children, and their partners on the streets of Chicago. The story revolves around incidents that occur in a kind of compressed piece of time, and in one case, one particular incident, which involves some questionable judgment. I can't really go into it because it's a piece of the plot, but the ramifications of that, plus their personal lives, get conflicted because of it.
And I'm guessing that the terrifying part has nothing to do with the fact that you're opening so close to Halloween.
No.
It's another kind of terrifying.
Another kind of terrifying. The other part of it is that the play itself is kind of a great vehicle for a place like the Station Theater, because it's really strict storytelling. It's two characters telling a rather complicated story as characters. So everything else is sort of stripped away. There's no scenery. There are no props in this play. So you're basically getting a story from character with some lights. It's rather interesting.
Yeah, before we talk about the specifics of this play with the two characters, and I think you may have worked out a couple of things to read for us from the show, very brief. Yes, kind of, maybe.
Yeah, I could do something
sure.
Very brief. It is tough to pull out anything that doesn't, you know, because so much of this actually is every sentence is progressing the story. Really, I mean, these two characters are the premise of it is the way it's constructed is that you go back and forth between the two actors. It's a duologue, and they both tell their version of what happened, and it's all done through retrospect. And so that being said, you know, so much of it does actually kind of tip the hand on the plot and stuff. So as for that reason, it's hard to pull something out. But also, it is it's raw. The characters. I think Matthew said it best when he said their vocabularies aren't very developed necessarily, but they are, you know, at the same time, it is poetic how it's constructed. A lot of these lines are very are beautiful in an odd way.
What you're also saying is we'd run into FCC regulations
if we
that's, run afoul of FCC regulations.
But I think we do have a couple of little pieces that would give you a flavor of the kind of language. That...
Okay. Before we do those, you know, Gary, I want to ask you kind of an unrelated question, and that is that you often take roles on both sides of the stage, as it were, both as an actor, which, you know, you do fabulously well, but also fairly frequently as a director, as, of course, you're doing in this case. And Matthew, all three of you have done that. But how do things change for you when you flip back and forth between those?
Well, I must say I consider myself an actor who directs. I don't really have the kind of organized mind that a really good director probably has. That being said, I do appreciate working with actors. It's a great pleasure for me. The one thing that is different is that your perspective is different. When you're acting, you're really just responsible for your character. And so you can be very egocentric about it. As a director, you really represent the play. So you have to have a wider view.
And do you ever find your actor self intruding on your director self?
Sometimes. I mean, I probably would say that too. I tend to sort of breathe for the actors sometimes.
I appreciate that actually as an actor. It's nice to have a director who is as experienced on stage as Gary, especially for something just such a character play like this. These characters are so in depth, and so I mean, you really get to spend a lot of time with each one of these characters, listening to them and hearing them really try to explain their actions, you know, in retrospect. So. These are not easy roles by any stretch of the imagination, and to have somebody with some acting chops and a lot of experience like Gary in our corner, you know, and trying kind of watching us and, you know, giving us some pointers and kind of honing what we were doing on stage was really nice. It worked out really great.
Mike, I've seen you a number of times in the last several weeks, it seems like, and I've actually
running
asked,
into each other.
Yeah, I've sort of asked you about this, so I might as well ask the question publicly, which is that I seem to have seen you primarily in comedies, mm-hmm. which may simply mean I've missed you in all the dramas. Well, but which is more difficult for you to act in a comic role or in this case, a distinctly not comic role?
That's such a loaded question. It really is. It's, you know, I tend to approach it as, you know, I'm more interested in the story and the character, whether or not the character is telling jokes or whether the character is, you know, relaying some sort of tragedy. I mean, if it's interesting, that's what I go for. I don't really go for the laughs or the tears or anything. It's more just what the character is portraying, or, you know, if something in the character speaks to me or whatever. As far as difficulty, it really is, you know, the best written characters are the most difficult. I've had comic roles that are very easy and very difficult, and I've had dramatic roles that are very easy and very difficult. And this one is up there. I'm telling people going in, this may be the most difficult thing I've ever done. It was the biggest challenge that I've faced, I think, as an actor.
Why would something that is well written be harder to do? I would have guessed the opposite.
Right. Well, if you think about it, I mean, what's easier to read, you know, like a, you know, teen fiction or an American classic? You know, it's like, it's something that's well written is very, there's a lot more there to digest. There's just, you know, you have to take bites, you have to chew and swallow and like really take your time with it and put in a lot more work on something that's well written, because there's just so much more there for you to work with and to get your mind around and to really portray, because it's just deeper. There's just a lot more going on.
More of the character to grasp.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Probably more decisions to be made too about what you want to do with that character.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of experienced actors, I think, fall back on the saying that comedy is harder. I'm not sure exactly why. I think good plays are just harder. You know, comedy takes a definite sense of timing and things, but you know, a good drama does too. I mean, just telling a story, whether it's funny or tragic, it takes timing. It takes wisdom. It takes time. It takes a lot of thought. So,
Matthew, it seems that unless I'm forgetting something, that all of the roles I've seen you in, you're somebody who is profoundly disturbed in some way or another. And I may have asked a question somewhat like this before, but is that easy for you to deal with, or does that come naturally to you?
I tend to gravitate for one reason or another toward characters like that, characters who are emotionally unbalanced or who have issues with, I don't know, rage. No, I mean, I've played a pretty wide spectrum, I guess. I mean, this is my 11th acting role at the station, and there have been some comedy scattered in there and some smaller roles. None of them are easy, and that's largely because I tend to make things harder than they have to be. But I don't know. I had an affinity for this particular role when I read it, simply because of the two men, this was the one I could see myself in more, which, come see the play and tell me how weird that is. But
is he therefore the more disturbed of the two?
I can't necessarily say that. I can say that he is...
Gary is nodding, by the way.
He's...
enthusiastically.
He is the alpha male in the relationship. He is the one who has some anger issues and some moral flexibility, but who also is a married man with kids and who justifies his actions because he's taking care of his family.
Hmm.
Both of these characters really are damaged, but Denny, which is Matthew's character, really has, he doesn't have the filter. He doesn't have the reins that Joey has kind of imposed upon himself. There's, you know, a certain social construct that Denny just lives without. He tends to either ignore it altogether or at least justify his actions within that construct, and in very odd ways. when he's explaining these things to you as an audience member after the fact, it's kind of, you can be shaking your head, but it's you know, it's easy to judge these characters from an audience perspective, but you know, as the story progresses, you can, you know, if you have a drop of empathy in you, you can see where both these characters are coming from.
Well, let's have whatever brief samples you can give us. Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Matthew Green and Mike Procise, who are the two cast members in a play by Keith Huff called A Steady Rain, which is directed by Gary Ambler, put on by the Celebration Company at the Station Theater in Urbana. It opened last night and continues through the 13th of November. Shows are at 8 o'clock, and there are some days where they don't have shows. You can check it out on the web address, which is stationtheater.com. So, what have you got?
I will be cutting this in the middle, just by the way. Denny went off the deep end that night. Me and a couple other cops, Varallo and Meese, we found him parked out on the flooded ninth hole of the Waveland Golf Course. He said he only had two or three beers, but it takes more net to tank Denny, a lot more. I found a couple spent vials of morphine and a syringe in a nearby sand trap. When we carried him back into his house, into the light, I could tell he'd been with Rhonda again. I could see on Connie's face that she knew too. Connie told us to throw him out on the fold-out on the back porch. Just in case he chucked cheese, it's the only place in the house besides the kitchen that's not shagged. Me and Connie stayed up most of the night kitchen, drinking coffee. I called in every hour on the hour over at Masonic to check on Stewie. It's the same, they told me. The same. Always the same. It's like the weather report. Always the same. Waiting. Waiting, waiting, and waiting. That's what that summer was about, really. It was an excruciating exercise in patience.
And that's Mike as Joey. Mike Procise as Joey. Matthew.
Sure. This is from the top of the show. This is our introduction to Denny and his worldview. We just signed on as a Nielsen family. You know, the ratings guys. They come into your home and attach this box to your TV. And all you do when you watch it, you pass around this remote, and whoever's watching what, they punch in their watching, right? They hooked a box up to the TV in Noel's room. There's even one buttoned up to the black and white kitchen set in a 38-inch boober me and Connie got in a boudoir. So the first night we got it, Connie, the kids, and me were all lounging around the family room figuring out how we can push all these buttons at once. You know, really screw up the Nielsen guys?
That's about it. I'll stop there. Otherwise, we're going to get into dialogue.
Sorry. All right. Well, that's the vaguest idea of some of what goes on. So a lot of this is sounds like monologue, but there's some dialogue
that goes on. Sometimes it does come into some just traditional scenes, but those come and go rather quickly.
Otherwise, characters in their own heads a little bit.
Yeah. It's a lot of it is in the mode of testimony, not necessarily like in a proper court, but telling the audience their side and trying sometimes very, very desperately to get them to believe their version of events, which don't always mesh.
Not altogether reliable characters.
Right. And I think sometimes unreliable narrators are the best ones. Makes the stories a lot more interesting.
Well, you got to think about it more, as you know, Mike said earlier, if it's well written, and in this case, if you don't know who you can trust, so is there a certain amount of, there's got to be a certain amount of working out on the part of the audience.
Yes.
Sure.
Who's telling the truth when, what's going on. And
right. I think, not necessarily a trap, but I think what, one thing that some audience members may fall into is, well, whose side were you on? You know, I think human nature, we want to choose sides. It's like, which guy did we either like better or hate the least?
who was the good guy?
Yeah,
who's the
good guy and who's the bad guy? And
or not as bad.
Brings up an interesting point, actually. Matthew's been in email communication a bit with the playwright, with Keith Huff. He's out of Chicago. And Mr. Huff was telling us that this play is being translated into a few languages, I believe Spanish and Hungarian?
Hungarian,
and
French.
It's being produced, I think, in Budapest here pretty soon, and the Hungarian translation of the title is actually going to be Good Cop, Bad Cop, which raises an interesting question, of course, which is the good cop, which is the bad cop. I brought this up to a friend last night, and they said it should be called Bad Cop, Worse Cop. So it's like, pick, you know, I think human nature is to pick which one we like the best, but it makes it very difficult to do that.
Well, people can attend the play and make their own judgments.
Yeah.
Judgments.
That's the idea.
Keith Huff's character is telling a, quote, hard, harrowing story about loyalty and corruption, unquote, from the Station Theater's website, Steady Rain, with Matthew Green, Mike Procise, and Director Gary Ambler. Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for more information and on the dates and tickets and so on, you can go to stationtheater.com. But the procedure is basically call the phone number. They'll make a reservation for you. You'll get a call back if there's a conflict. Other than that, your tickets will be held at the door. And what's the phone number?
384-4000.
Thanks very much. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our programs today are made possible with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center with fitness and wellness facilities, including Cardinal Fitness and now open Amara Yoga. Stay tuned for a conversation with James Smelser, a horn player in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. We'll be right back. ever-popular opening to the Fifth Symphony of Ludwig van Beethoven, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Schulte. He was the music director when I lived in Chicago. He was the music director of the symphony, had been there for many, many years, and that's essentially the Chicago Symphony Orchestra I got to know and love and sometimes think different things about. He was replaced when he, now I'm forgetting, did he die before he retired? He retired before he died, by Daniel Barenboim, who was there for quite some years. And he recently left the orchestra, and the new music director is in place, Ricardo Muti. And the symphony goes on tour, sometimes with this music director, sometimes not. And in this case, they're coming with a guest conductor, Jaap van Zweden, to the Krannert Center in Urbana tomorrow night for a concert that includes music by John Adams and Mahler and Dmitri Shostakovich. And we'll be hearing more about that in just a moment. Let me mention also that support for our show today comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. My guest on this portion of Live and Local is a member of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra horn section. His name is Jim Smelser, and they're going to be at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana Saturday night at 7:30 under a guest conductor, Jaap van Zweden, and they're playing a wonderfully, wonderful, wonderfully varied and powerful program. And the reason I asked to talk to Jim specifically is that we actually went to school together at Northwestern, although he's racking his brain to remember that. I remember it pretty well because he was one of the finest horn players who was in the school at the time. I was decidedly not. And so I thought it might be fun to talk to him. In any event, Jim, thanks for joining us on the show.
You're welcome.
How long have you been in the Chicago Symphony?
I joined the orchestra in February of 2000.
So what is that? A little over about 10 and a half years.
First time I played was in 1986 as an extra, so I played for 14 years as an extra, and finally won an audition in 2000.
And how many times of trying did it take you to finally win that audition?
Eight or nine. That's the truth. I was in the finals 5 times, and I think it was 8 or 9 total auditions.
And
for various positions.
And what other orchestras have you played in leading up to that? Or did you stick around Chicago the whole time?
Almost the whole time. Most recently before that, I played in San Francisco for 1 year as a utility player in 1998-99 season. And then in 1989, I played for a year in Germany. I played principal horn in the Philharmonica Hungarica, as it was called.
And how many other orchestras did you audition for in that time? I'm assuming you didn't put all of your eggs into the Chicago Symphony's basket.
No, quite a few. Some smaller orchestras in the country. Also auditioned for the Western Australia Symphony Orchestra in Perth. And I won that audition at that time, chose to go to Germany in 1989, the Philharmonia Ungarica, as it was called. But quite a few orchestras. I would say probably a good 10 or 12 different orchestras, and some auditioned more than once.
So just because I'm guessing that most of our listeners don't really know what's involved in this whole auditioning experience and how many times people can try and not get anywhere, which doesn't necessarily mean you're not a good horn player, because you wouldn't have landed in the CSO if you weren't. What is involved in that whole process of trying to get an audition in the first place, doing the audition, making the finals? How does that all work?
Well, I'll tell you some of the details. You first will see an opening posted, usually in a trade publication in our union magazine, and you'll write or call, send in your resume. These days you're required to send in an audition deposit just so you actually show up for the audition, and that's refunded to you when you arrive. Sometimes the repertoire is sent in advance, with or without music, and you'll go to the place that it's at, and for the auditions I took in Denver and New York and New Orleans and Los Angeles, Had to fly, and some of the other ones in Columbus and Indianapolis and St. Louis, I drove. Nashville, I drove. Birmingham, I flew. Salt Lake City, I flew. The list goes on and on. So you arrive at the audition, and you'll check yourself into your hotel the night before and go to the hall that day, and you're assigned a number, and it could be maybe number 89 because they're on the second or third day of auditioning. Here at the Chicago Symphony, I don't remember how many applicants were in total for the position that I won, but it was quite a few. And you're assigned a number, and you will go and play the exposition, the first part of the first movement of a concerto by Mozart, and then you'll play a list of excerpts or pieces from horn repertoire from the orchestral literature. And if you please the committee, you'll play more excerpts, and then a decision will be made that you've made the next cut, which would be the semifinals. And that would happen usually on another day, could be a week or more later, and then you would play a semifinal round. And again, if you advanced, you'd be in the finals. Up until this point, there's a screen, so everything was anonymous, the whole process. At the Chicago Symphony, the audition committee consists of 9 members. In each instance, you need 6 votes to advance. So if you make it to the finals and the screens are removed, and at that point the music director is there with the 9 member committee, you would play again, and a vote would be taken. And if you qualified, meaning you got those 6 votes, at that point then the maestro would ask you to play some more detailed things, perhaps some sight reading, some music you have never seen, and you would play with the section, and they would just check sound and color and balance and blend. And then the committee would deliberate and offer you the job, and then that would start a 2-year probation process with a review halfway through, and then after 2 years, if they wait that long, they would award you your tenure.
And there you are for life.
Here I am.
And speaking of for life, the guy who was the principal horn player of Chicago Symphony is Dale Clevenger. And he's actually the reason that I am in Illinois, mm-hmm. although ironically I never ended up studying with him. But you did.
I did.
At Northwestern for the whole time or not quite?
No, I started off studying with Norman Schweikert, who at that time was the second horn player, had the position before me. I studied with Norman Schweikert for 2 years, and then I left and went to Germany to study with Gerd Seifert, who at that time was the principal of the Berlin Philharmonic, then came back and studied with Dale Clevenger. And Dale's been here since February of 1966. I was 5, almost 6 at that time.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I hadn't realized he'd been there that long till I read the bios here. So as a horn player, I would imagine that it's even more critical than maybe some of the other instruments that you hold your nerve during the auditions, because so many things can go wrong with a horn. Isn't that a big aspect of doing auditions?
It's just psychology? It is, and I think what's very key is when you're talking specifically about an audition or winning that audition is to really prepare yourself for what you're going to have to do on that day. Many people practice their excerpts in their preferred order at home, and when you come to an audition, the order might be scrambled, and the slightest thing could just throw you into a tizzy. So I would mix up the excerpts all the time, and forwards and backwards, and put excerpts after each other that I would never want to play, meaning make it the most difficult possible. So the idea is that you come in to the audition not fearing anything, and many candidates say to themselves, boy, I hope they don't ask this of me today. You might have a list of 20, 25 excerpts, and maybe you only have to play 6, but you won't know which 6 until you're here. But you really have to go in there with the attitude that you can play anything, and you really hope they'll ask you everything, because you want to have a chance to show what you can do.
And getting to that aspect where you said you play with the horn section, that's really the ultimate test. You know, do you have the sound that matches the other players? How much does that depend on the instrument itself? I know some orchestras, everybody owns the same kind of instrument, but that's not true with CSO, is it?
Well, we basically play the same type of instruments now. We basically all play horns made by Steve Lewis, a maker here in Chicago. But I think sound is a sound and color is a concept in your head, and what you perceive and how you want to be heard. It's very possible for two people to play the same type of instrument and sound very different. Some physical playing reasons account for that, how you physically play the horn, but mostly it's really a concept, and it is your job to notice what you're hearing around you and always adapt and blend. For the audition, I was actually looking forward to that point and hoping that I would have a chance to play with the section because I knew their sound and felt that I would be a good fit.
When the screen is taken away, and for those who don't know, that means you actually sit behind this thing. Nobody knows what you look like until those final stages. Why do they remove the screen at that point? Does it somehow matter what you look like then?
I don't think it matters what you look like, but having been on the other side of an audition screen, I think it's a good thing because I think it puts the pieces in your mind, what you've been hearing all along. Now you've heard a candidate play, and you take notes when you're on the committee, and you hear this person in the first round, the second round, and then away comes the screen, and you see them. It just kind of makes sense. It doesn't mean at all that you're chosen or not chosen by what you see. It's somehow, for me, comforting to connect with the person that you're listening to by being able to see them, especially if you're choosing them for a colleague. But all steps are made that the process is very fair and very anonymous. Here, like many places, there's a carpet laid across the hall, the stage. I mean, as you approach your spot to play, I remember in the old days, this wasn't always the case, and this came about because women could be detected by the types of shoes that they wore, and you would know that this is a female candidate. So that was done just to make sure that everything was anonymous. Here in the hall, we have above the stage kind of a sound reflecting device, and lights are shown into that device, so there's no reflection, so you can't look from the audience if he's playing on stage. Even to that extent, just to make it fair. I mean, the object is to really make the candidate feel comfortable, so that they can actually produce, their best playing that day. And I think, for me personally, I always preferred to play for people, meaning without a screen. And when the screen was there, I always just imagined I was playing for somebody and not just the back of a screen.
Well, and in your case, when they took the screen away, all of a sudden these guys who you had played with off and on as an extra for many years, I would think that it could well have been to your advantage to say, aha, we already know this guy. It's nice to know he made it this far. That would give you a leg up, I would think.
Yes and no. Yes and no. Remember, if you've taken so many auditions, they've seen you in this spot before.
Oh.
they know what you can do, and they also know maybe the reasons why they didn't or couldn't give you the job before, and like to see you overcome that or do better or prove to them what you didn't do or couldn't do before. For me, it was a relief because now you're seeing the people that you know, but you know it's deadly serious. You still have to do your job.
When one talks about principal horn or principal oboe or principal second violin, for that matter, but I guess particularly principal horn, what does that mean to the section? I mean, obviously, Dale's going to get the big solos when they're, most of the time, when it's not assigned to a third horn player. But what is his effect on the section? What does he do as a section leader that makes him the leader?
Well, that's a great question with several complicated answers, but basically that provides the absolute inspirational direction and leadership of the group. It's assumed that playing in the upper range and being comfortable with solos, exposed passages, comes naturally to the player, which is true, but really he is our leader and chooses for us the direction of our sound and our approach to the level of quality of the music that we make. Without a leader who absolutely insists on this quality, it's not the same thing. And that's the one thing that he's absolutely insistent about and comes very natural to him, that absolute perfection and the highest level possible is always there.
So is he, you know, if somebody down the line, you know, makes a mistake in rehearsal or something, is he going to turn over and glare at you? Or if, you know, somebody's out of tune, will he make suggestions, or is it all pretty much done silently?
Another great question. Never any glaring and never any embarrassments whatsoever, because we all make mistakes. And I think the longer you play, the more you realize that everybody makes mistakes. I think it would be an issue if mistakes were made and we weren't aware of it, and we therefore couldn't try to make a correction. But sometimes a word will be spoken, something about along the lines, if there's four of us playing and we need to play a certain type of tenuto passage or accented tenuto passage, that we do it all the same. But usually not immediately, because we'll hear what's going on and pick up on what everybody else is doing and then, you know, come to a unified sound.
We're listening to a conversation from just a couple days ago with James Smelser, who was a horn player in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I caught him in Chicago right after a rehearsal that they were having that included this week's program. Tomorrow night at the Krannert Center in Urbana, they're playing music by John Luther Adams, Dark Waves for Orchestra and Electronic Sounds, Gustav Mahler, Songs from Das Knaben Wunderhorn, and the Eighth Symphony of Dmitri Shostakovich, for which this is just a fragment of the very opening. Just the tiniest fragment of the opening of a rather long movement that begins the Eighth Symphony of Dmitri Shostakovich, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, in this performance conducted by Sir George Schulte. We'll continue my conversation with Jim Smelser of the horn section of the symphony, which is coming to the Krannert Center in Urbana tomorrow evening. the brass players in certain quarters have the reputation for really loving to play loud. And some would say that the Chicago Symphony Brass Section is especially adept at playing loud.
Mm-hmm. I agree, but I always add, and people ask similar type questions, but I would also say that rarely will you hear a brass section play as soft as what we can do. You're right. We could absolutely peel the paint off the back wall.
How often does that back wall have to be repainted because of the horns?
Well, it's never been repainted, but... But in all seriousness, I mean, we always try to play with taste, and discretion is always used. But taste is a moving target, and what a conductor might think or like, and what we think is the best way, we have to come to a decision by concert time. But certainly, the brass section is known for that, and can hopefully produce great quality sound at a high volume. But again, I'll add. When you hear unison pianissimos, it will take your breath away, particularly from the trombone section.
When I was in school, I remember that brass players, and I certainly observe this with high school and college players now, they tended to like playing things like Mahler, Shostakovich, Bruckner, that have, we would say, the great brass parts. But I've kind of wondered since then, listening to music by Wagner, say a Wagner opera for that matter, some of these other pieces where you're playing loud and almost constantly, whether one might not dread those parts after a while because you have to play so much of the time and they must be exhausting. Do you have favorite kinds of pieces to play or some that are not your favorites to play?
Well, I like that music. Not all pieces equally, but I like that music. I don't mind the work that we have to put into it or the volume, but I should say, for example, in a Bruckner symphony, the fourth, for example, or the fifth, some of the difficulty comes not from just playing the loud passages, but the very soft passages that follow. A lot of people can play loud, but to follow it up with really soft, delicate playing, that's something a little different. My personal favorite composers are Mozart and Brahms.
Hmm. And Mozart and, let's say, Haydn, for horn players, can be incredibly difficult, partly because of the delicacy that you were just talking about.
Sure. The early symphonies of Haydn and Mozart, but mostly Haydn, are quite high and tricky for the horn.
What can you tell me about the guest conductor you're working with this week, Jaap van Zweden?
Yeah, I'm almost interrupting you. I'm jumping in so fast. I can't speak highly enough of him. He is absolutely fantastic. To me, he's exactly what an orchestra who's willing to learn and improve needs. He brings great professionalism to us and has the respect of the entire orchestra. He's a real musician's musician. He was the concertmaster of the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. And we know that, and we see that, so we have great respect. When he asks for us to do things, we know why he's asking, and we also know why he does the things that he does, because he knows what players need from a conductor, the help that you need. So he's been here before, and each time he comes, we look forward to it. He's really fantastic.
Without naming names, unless you really want to, what would make... what would be some characteristics of certain conductors that would be not as helpful as you just described his being?
Well, basically, I think when a conductor comes in and the emphasis and the focus, and this is a delicate question to answer, but when the emphasis and the focus is on him and not the music.
And do you get that very often?
Sometimes. I think speaking, I'm never comfortable speaking for other people, but if I were to guess what most members of this orchestra prefer, it's someone who's really up there for the sake of the music. And there's different ways to interpret it, and that's fine. But when something becomes more about the individual, not the music, that's difficult.
And does that become obvious to, let's say, management from the orchestra that you feel that way, and that person likely not to get asked back, or might that not be a determining factor?
Well, again, that's a delicate thing to comment on. Sometimes these conductors do come back because they're well known and they're liked by the audience and by the public. But if you're going to ask a musician a personal question, hopefully you'll get an honest answer. But our management does usually find out how we feel about a conductor and can just sense something about the connection between the orchestra and a conductor. With our music director, for example, that's a great way to look at it.
Well, I was just going to ask about him, and it's unfortunate that he's had to bow out of some of the concerts this fall because of illness. I hope he's doing well by now. But talk a little bit about Riccardo Muti.
Well, he is really, we're so lucky to have him, to have Muti at the right time and the right place for us. We were, you know, well taken care of with Haitink being here more than he would have been and Boulez being here more than he would have been in the interim time. But you never want to lose time and momentum to move forward with you know, vision for the orchestra and developing the sections and just working together. However, in that time period when Barenboim left and Muti came, I think we did well with those two conductors. But we're so glad he's here. We feel he's a great musician and has nothing but 100% respect from the musicians, not just because he's our boss, our music director, but because we believe he really, really is about the music.
I want to lead my last question with a kind of an opinion. When I used to follow Riccardo Muti a little bit when he was with the Philadelphia Orchestra, you know, my exposure was probably as much as anything to the pictures of him you'd see on his record covers and then some recordings that I heard and articles you read about him. And I always thought, oh, this guy seems to be an arrogant SOB. And then he got in trouble with the Milan Orchestra. I'm forgetting what the name of the opera is there. La Scala. And then he came to the Krannert Center a few years ago with the Vienna Philharmonic, and everything changed because it was one of the most astounding concerts I ever heard. It was so obvious that the orchestra and he were totally in sync. I thought he'd be one of these flamboyant arm wavers. He seemed to be really quite understated. Of course, I'll also add that I was surprised how short he was, as with so many conductors. But what was there, from your perspective, with the few times that he has worked with the symphony, that said to you, assuming it said to you, this guy is somebody we'd really like to have?
That's just a, you just have a feeling. He had not conducted here for many years. I don't remember how many exactly, maybe 27 years, up in the upper 20s, had not been here for many, many years. And so I had never had the chance to play under him until he had come here. And then we went on tour with him in 2007. But you just have a feeling that it works well, that he enjoys himself, that he respects the musician and recognizes what's in front of him and recognizes our willingness to work hard for him to make great music. And we went on tour. We went on about a 10-day tour of Italy in 2007. And touring on the road, we could talk about that also at length, can be very difficult. It's very taxing. It's physically demanding. But it's all worthwhile for many reasons, but most of which is when you're really able to make good music away from home. And that we were able to do. And I think he has mentioned that too, that was one of the deciding factors for him to be interested in coming here, is that he had such a great time making music in 2007 on tour with us.
Because he had declared before that he wasn't going to take any more music directorships, and yet he decided to come to Chicago.
Right. Those were his official statements, and maybe that was part of a strategy, but whatever that may be, it worked out for us, and we're glad and lucky that he's here.
Well, we hope that his health is doing fine, and he'll be back in the spring, I guess, to work with you. And really looking forward to hearing the Chicago Symphony Saturday night at the Krannert Center under guest conductor Jaap van Sweden and soprano, good grief, I don't know how to pronounce her name.
We don't either. We suspect she's from from Holland.
Although she's from Canada, actually, I read.
From Canada, we weren't sure.
Yeah, Misha Brugger-Gosman, it looks like, something like that. Somebody new to me.
She's very energetic and very great, has a very clear voice, and we're excited about it. I just wanted to make sure that I said this. We love playing in Krannert. We feel that hall has great acoustics. It's not that long of a drive from Chicago, and every time we've gone there, we've loved it. I first played there in 1974 as a high school student coming to the youth summer music camps, the 1 week and the 2 week camps down there. But we always love it, just like when we go to Carnegie, because it's a great, great hall, and the audience is so appreciative of our concerts.
And Jim Smeltzer is horn player with the Chicago Symphony. What do you play, second, third, fourth, Jim?
Second horn.
So you followed in the footsteps of your first teacher at Northwestern.
That's right.
Norman Schweikert. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Soprano Lucia Popp with the Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam, led by Leonard Bernstein, in Wer hat dies Liedlein erdacht, which means, who thought up this song? From the Youth's Magic Horn, Das Knabenwunderhorn of Gustav Mahler, you can hear four songs from Das Knabenwunderhorn in a performance by the Chicago Symphony tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana with Misha Brugger-Gosman. It's WYLL. FM and HD Urbana with HD1 and HD2 Urbana, translators W266 AF and W293 AF Danville.